Yes, well, actually, I should start the talk. In India, we start talks by saying Namo Buddhaya Jai Bhim. So I'll just turn this on. Yes, so the topic of Dr. Ambedkar is very dear to my heart as well. I do go to India regularly, and I'm very inspired by the story of Buddhism in India. So I hope to share some of that with you this afternoon. So the title of the talk is What is the Importance of Dr. Ambedkar to the Western World? But I'm going to narrow it down a bit and talk about Western Buddhists, to Western Buddhists, because I think that he has a different relevance to non-Buddhists, a great relevance, actually. But we're going to focus on Buddhists this afternoon because, of course, we are in a Buddhist centre and hopefully you've all got a connection with Buddhism. Yes, and there's a lot of different ways to approach the question of Dr. Ambedkar's importance. Actually, I've recently completed a Mitra study course about Dr. Ambedkar for Mitras, mainly in the UK and Europe and America, so basically outside of India, because I think it would be a slightly different module in India. But and it's been my great pleasure and an honour to do so, because it's been absolutely fascinating for me to really do more study on Dr. Ambedkar. And as I look into his life and work, more and more is revealed. So he's one of the world's great reformers. Normally when we think of great reformers, we might think of Gandhi or Martin Luther King or some of those kind of great figures. But actually, Dr. Ambedkar stands, I think, above those figures in a lot of ways. But very little is known about him in the West. Actually, where I live, so I live in rural Wales, and I go to a Qigong class. And my Qigong class have now become experts in Dr. Ambedkar. partly because my teacher's daughter wanted to do a project on him, and she came round for the day, and we talked, and I talked. She asked intelligent questions. I gave her the book Dr. Ambedkar and Buddhism, which is by Sangharakshita, and I really recommend you read it. It's a very, very good book and a very good grounding in Dr. Ambedkar's life and work. And the next week I went to my Qigong class, and my teacher, Jack, said to me, I started to look at that book. It's amazing. He's just kept saying, it is amazing. Like, why have we never heard about them? Why is this man not talked about in schools? You know, why have I never heard of the name Dr. Ambedkar? I've heard of all sorts of other world reformers, but what about Dr. Ambedkar? So I think it's good that we do know a bit more about him, and I think actually he is becoming more popular and more well-known, even in the West. Because it is an amazing story. He was born into the lowest strata of Indian society. In Indian society, in Hindu Indian society, the society was divided, and still is to a certain extent, into castes. And the lowest caste were known as the untouchables, so-called untouchables. And really, you've got to kind of imagine the absolute horror of what that means. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but untouchable means just that. It means that if you're touched by anyone from a higher caste, they become polluted simply by that human contact. The people from that community, I won't use the word untouchable because obviously no one's untouchable in reality. It was a construct from society. But I'll use the term scheduled caste. So from those scheduled castes, they weren't allowed to use the same water supply. They weren't allowed to be educated. They weren't allowed to attend the Hindu temples. They weren't allowed to own land. They had to keep into their family occupation, which was the lowest menial work, usually. And in many places in India, that still holds true. And sometimes what we might get in the news is we might get the real atrocities that are used to keep caste system in place, extreme violence, murder and rape, in order to keep that system in place. So if anyone from the scheduled caste tries to own land or better themselves, extreme violence can be used to stop them from doing that. But in a way, actually, that extreme violence is masks something much more endemic. It's the sort of lack of access to resources, the lack of the ongoing oppression and discrimination, lack of resources to education, change in career, and all those things. So it's a system of what Dr. Anne Baker called graded inequality, as one of, I think, possibly the worst system of inequality in the world that human beings have ever produced. So Dr. Anne Baker was born into that community, but by a combination of hard work and dedication, I mean serious hard work, his father used to wake him up at 2 o'clock in the morning when he was a teenager to study. I can't imagine many British teenagers being woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning to study by a little gas lamp, But yes, he was very, very intelligent, exceptionally intelligent, and through hard work and dedication, and the help of particularly two forward-thinking Maharajas, he was the first person from the scheduled caste to finish high school. And he became, the most educated man in India. He got a PhD at Columbia University in America, a PhD in London School of Economics in London, and he was called to the bar at Gray's Inn. So he was a seriously intelligent man, very, very hardworking. And he became the first law minister of independent India, and drafted the Constitution of India. So I just wanted to read you the opening page, the preamble for the Constitution of India, because I think it's a thing of great beauty and great ideals. And it's based, and I'll say a bit more about this, it's based on Buddhist principles. It says, "We, the people of India, having solemnly resolved to constitute India into a sovereign, socialist, secular, democratic republic, and to secure to all its citizens justice, social, economic and political, liberty of thought, expression, belief, faith and worship, equality of status and opportunity, and to promote among them all fraternity, assuring the dignity of the individual and the unity and integrity of the nation. In our Constituent Assembly on this 26th day of November 1949, do hereby adopt, enact, and give to ourselves this Constitution." So here was Dr. Ambedkar. He drafted this Constitution, assuring the dignity of the individual and the unity and integrity of the nation, based in liberty, inequality, and fraternity. It's a thing of great beauty, the Indian Constitution. It's like the highest kind of ideals of how society could live. But unfortunately, it takes more than a good constitution to ensure that those values are upheld. You can make the best constitution in the world, but if people aren't ready to really adopt it into everyday life, you'll still get things like caste discrimination. Drafting the constitution wasn't enough. So I think the thing about Ambedkar that makes him truly special is that he had the education and clear thinking and political and social action combined with the absolute dedication to the uplift of his people and eradicating social injustice. And he saw that even writing the constitution, even having liberty, equality and fraternity enshrined in law wasn't enough. It's not just about political and even economic uplift as an end in itself. Dr. Ambedkar had a real vision for a spiritual vision for the world becoming, in his land, a pure land. A land of, not only political and economic solutions, but also spiritual uplift of the individual. And this is why he didn't actually adopt communism. There's a very interesting paper he wrote called The Buddha or Karl Marx. And he didn't adopt communism, like a lot of people from his community did, because he said that man must grow materially as well as spiritually. So I think that's what makes Dr. Ambedkar very relevant to us, is that he's got this kind of the strand of education and changing the political situation in India and reforming the political situation in India. But he also has a vision for the spiritual uplift of humanity. He says, man's life is independent. He is born not for the service of the society, but for his self-development. And he really saw that that was possible. He really saw that the spiritual development of the individual is possible. And he thought that the best means to spiritual development was religion. He was a very religious man by nature, and he thought religion was necessary for the individual and for society. He says, the basic idea underlying religion is to create an atmosphere of the spiritual development of the individual. So that's what I want to go into this afternoon, is to talk a little bit about what his thinking was and why it was important, why it's important for us in the West, us as Buddhists in the West. Because although he said that religion was necessary for society, he also realised that not all religions are worth having, in his language. And he looked at all the world's religions in quite some depth, actually, and decided in the end that Buddhism was the best religion for society. And as Sujata said, 61 years ago, he converted to Buddhism with 400,000 of his followers. So I want to look at this by looking at it. For some reason, the idea of the structure of this talk came to me as a tantric biography. In tantric biographies, they move from the external to the internal to the secret. So that's what I'm going to do. So it will become a little bit less defined as it moves. But we'll see how we go. So externally, I think the reason that why Dr. Ambedkar is very important to us in the West is that he pointed out to Buddhists the social dimension of Buddhism. And the social dimension of Buddhism is he thought that Buddhism was an aid to create that spiritual atmosphere for the development of the individual. And Buddhism was important, or is important, to create a just and democratic society in which individuals can flourish. He thought that Buddhism was essential. He saw that change in law wasn't enough, that didn't actually end caste discrimination. And he thought, well, if it can't be law, it's got to be Buddhism. And this is important for us to get a hold of, because there's a tendency in the West particularly for Buddhism, and Buddhism in general actually, to lead to laziness. There's something in Buddhism itself that can lead us to inertia. And in the West, that combines with the culture that also has a tendency to individualism. So there's a philosopher called Zizek who really criticised Western Buddhism, because he said what Western Buddhism does is it allows you to be sort of more mindful and a bit more positive, and then you have the illusion that you can stand above the political situation because it doesn't apply to you. So you'll see this a lot in Buddhist centres in the West, where, well, we don't want to listen to the news because it doesn't really apply to us. And we can have this feeling that because I feel positive and because I meditate and I'm changing my mind, the sort of political situation and what's going on in the world doesn't apply to me. That's basically because we've lived in a country of privilege, to put it quite frankly. So it doesn't need to apply to us, because basically we've got enough money to not worry about it. Zizek said that Western Buddhism is very good for a capitalist society, because what it does is it means you refine your aesthetics to a certain point of view, for a certain point. But yes, you have this opinion that you're just standing above things, so you become very passive in the political situation. You become a passive consumer, basically. And your consuming is more refined, but basically you're still consuming. You're just a bit more zen in your interior decoration, basically. I mean, you know, this is your... I think it's wonderful. I think that's a really good thing to think about. I think the best thing you can have is someone who really, really criticises you as a group of people. Actually, Sangharakshita talked about this. He talked about it as pseudo... I've completely forgotten that. Pseudo-aesthetic experience. It's sort of... You're more refined, but actually you're becoming quite individualistic. You're not really looking at the society in which you're living. Pseudo-spiritual aestheticism, that's what he calls it. And Sangharakshita says, without the idea of transforming world as well as self, our going for refuge, our Buddhist practice, is in danger of becoming an individualistic affair, and to that extent in danger of not being truly going for refuge at all. So, you know, there is because you're working on your mind a lot in Buddhism, there is this tendency to be quite sort of inward looking and to focus on one's own sort of psychological problems. And Ambedkar turned that vision of Buddhism on its head. And he actually called the Bhikkhu Sangha, the monastic Sangha, the huge army of idlers. Yeah, if I'm direct, I've got nothing on Dr. Ambedkar. So what Dr. Ambedkar did is he unites the social and the individual. He saw that society is there for the development of the individual, but he also saw that if the individual is going to develop, you need a society that supports that development. And he said that the Dharma is fundamentally and necessarily social. He said that the Dharma is a force for good in the world. And he said it's not enough to be a good Buddhist. You've got to believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. So he takes us out of our kind of inward-looking individual world and makes us look up at society and the conditions in which we live and think about our spiritual development, not just as my spiritual development, but as a collective spiritual development. How is each of us going to progress in society? And is society supporting individual progression? So why is this? Why did he think that Buddhism was so important for society? So he said that a true and just society has to be based on morality. And where will that morality come from? Well, will it come from law? That will be the first way of thinking about it. Well, it can't come from law. Morality and a true and just society can't just be enshrined in law, because the law basically reflects society's thinking. And so, you know, usually if society believes in caste, the law will reflect that belief. And even if you can change the law, so he managed to change the law within the Constitution of India, law can only enforce a minority. So the Constitution of India is a beautiful and wonderful thing, but is it upheld? Well, no, it's not upheld, because it can only be upheld by law, and law is necessarily only going to reach a few people. Actually, he said about the Constitution of India, in the end, he said it was a palace on a dung heap. He said, we've created this beautiful palace, and a devil has taken possession of it. And why is that? Because the majority doesn't follow the law. The majority follows an internal and collective moral system. And if that collective and moral system believes in caste, that's what they're going to follow. So he thought that a moral system, a universal moral system, must be in place. And what moral system could that be? Well, that moral system is a Buddhist moral system, because Buddhist morality is sacred and universal, in his words. So Buddhist morality is universal. It applies to everybody. You can't take out of Buddhism morality. You can't just say, okay, well, we've got an ethical system for the Buddhists, but everyone else is on a different system. And, you know, I'm not going to practice Buddhist morality, because Buddhist morality is the foundation for all the rest of our spiritual practice. And it applies to everyone. It doesn't matter who they are. In fact, the Buddha said, even if someone were to saw you to pieces with a two-handled saw to give rise to anger, you're not my disciple. So what he was saying there, I mean, it's, you know, he's using a dramatic effect, but what he's saying there is Buddhist ethics applies all the time. It doesn't matter what set of circumstances you're in, or who you're talking to, or who you're interacting with. Buddhist ethics always applies. And why are they sacred? So that's why they're universal. But why is Buddhist morality sacred? It's sacred because it's based on reality. So Buddhist morality is what's called a natural moral system. It's based on the way things are, an understanding on the way things are. So it said that if you see the way things are, you see that all beings are growing and developing, and all beings have the potential to Buddhahood. And if you can see that, and you can see that we're not fixed and we're not separate, and if you can see that, your natural response to other beings is of love and of care and of an ethical response. So from the Buddhist point of view, there's something about, it's an ethical universe. Not that the universe always is good, it's more that if you understand the way things are, your only response is to behave ethically. And if you want to understand the way things are, you've got to behave ethically. And the more you behave ethically, you set up the conditions for understanding the way things are. So it's a moral system, it's a natural moral system in the sense that it's not true because the Buddha said so. It's a function of the way things actually are and seeing into reality. And it's based on principles. It's not based on a set of rules. It's based on true and deep principles. It's based on acting out of love, of wisdom and contentment. So for Buddhism, ethics are absolutely central. You can't take them out of Buddhism or apply them to one set of circumstances and not another. Dr. Ambedkar said, the religion of Buddha is morality. It is embedded in religion. Buddhist religion is nothing if not morality. It is true that in Buddhism there is no God. In place of God, there is morality. What God is to other religions, morality is to Buddhism. So he thought that Buddhism was necessary for society because it has a sacred and universal moral system that you cannot take out of Buddhism. And it's quite a thing to think about that. I mean, if we could imagine a world that was all following the Buddhist system of ethics and was very committed to a real commitment, yes, to that Buddhist ethical system and having that ethical system at its core. What that kind of society would be like, where people were completely honest, had a commitment to honesty and non-violence. I mean, of course, one might argue at this point, well, what about countries like Myanmar, where, of course, it's a Buddhist country and people... Well, it seems as if they're committing genocide against the Rohingya Muslims. And that's why I say it has to be a real commitment to Buddhist ethics, not just taking it up in name only. Because I think there's all sorts of other forces going on at the same time, particularly in Myanmar, the force of nationalism. So what would it be like if we could follow and be committed to a system of Buddhist ethics above and beyond all other forces, the forces of consumerism, the forces of nationalism? It would be quite an incredible thing, actually. And of course, that's what we have in a Buddhist centre. We can't change the whole of society, but within our Buddhist centres, we can make an absolute commitment to the practice of Buddhist ethics. And even if we can't make the whole of the UK Pure Land, well, we can make our little Sangha. We can practice to make our Sanghas little Pure Lands. It's not always an easy practice, but that's the idea. A friend of mine told me a story about going to Nagpur, and he had a taxi driver who wasn't a Buddhist. And as they were going through, it was at night, they were going to where he was staying from the airport. He said, "Oh, that's a Buddhist slum, and you'll be safe there any time of day and night. You're completely safe if you go there." And then he kept on driving. He said, "That's a Hindu slum. Don't go there at all, any time of day or night." And my friend was really shocked, actually, that he could be so honest about it, because he wasn't a Buddhist. So I think there is something to do that, you know, to have that faith that in Buddhist, people have a true commitment to living out Buddhist ethics, you are safe. You know what you can expect, a certain behaviour. So he said, it's not just that Buddhist ethics are sacred and universal. He said it's also that Buddhist ethics are based in liberty, equality and fraternity. And he said he got those qualities not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. Because Buddhism teaches that everyone should be free to follow their chosen path, whether you're a renunciant or a householder, whatever career you want, whoever you want to marry or be friends with. Buddhism teaches that people should be free to follow their own path. It seems so obvious. It seems so obvious in our society that you'd be free to marry who you want or be friends with who you want or even eat with who you want or even share the same drinking water as who you want or even walk down the same street as who you want to walk down the same street as. But in India, that's not always the case because of the caste system. So it's quite a revolutionary thing, actually. And the Buddha was absolutely against the caste system. His first conversation after his enlightenment was to a Brahmin called Hahunkajanka, which means huffing. Because he was all like that all the time. And he said to the Buddha, "Well, who are you?" sort of thing. "You're not a Brahmin." And the Buddha was like, "You know." And he said, "Well, what makes a Brahmin then?" And the Buddha said, gave him quite a long answer, essentially saying, "Actually, it's your actions that make you a Brahmin. It's your actions who make you a kind of great man. It's not your birth. It's your actions." So from that point of view, the Buddha made the Sangha open to all. He said that it's a bit like a great ocean. Many castes, many streams run into the great rivers and streams run into the great ocean. And once they're in the ocean, they lose their identity. And so it is, many castes flow into the Sangha, but they lose their identity, caste identity. And there was one incident where some Brahmins came to take refuge with the Buddha. Along with their barber, their hairdresser. And the Buddha ordained the hairdresser first so that they would always be, so that the hairdresser, the barber, would always be in a senior position to them in the Sangha because he was ordained first. So Buddhism promotes liberty and equality, but it also promotes fraternity. And this, Dr. Ambedkar said, is the true foundation for democracy. Democracy just won't work as a political position unless it's founded in fraternity. And how he defined fraternity was fellow feeling, or metta, maitri or metta, loving kindness, respect for others, desire for unity. And he said without that basis, without the basis of metta, democracy is not possible. He said that democracy is not just a kind of political system or a way of governance. Democracy is a state of mind, and that state of mind is metta, maitri. And he said that really, if you want to eradicate injustice, you've got to change the mind, because that's where injustice comes from. Inequality arises out of views. It arises out of ideas. And we've really seen this recently, I think particularly after the Brexit vote, where there's been a lot of intolerance towards different communities within the UK. And you can see that a lot of it is based on factually incorrect information. It's not about what's true. It's about an idea that people are holding, a kind of view that people are holding, which they're just clinging onto again and again and again. Inequality or caste is not a thing. It's not a brick wall. It's not barbed wire. It's nothing you can hold on to or remove physically. It's a state of mind. It's a state of mind of dividing society into me and other. And he said, what the mind creates, the mind can undo. Well, that's a profoundly optimistic position. What the mind creates, the mind can undo. If we can change our minds to be based in metta, in fraternity, then we will change society. We will create a democracy. But if we don't change our minds, democracy is not possible. He said it requires a notional change, a transformation of mind and soul. And he said that every great social revolution is preceded by a revolution of mind, a revolution of thought. So a true and just society is based on an attitude. It doesn't matter how good the political system is. You've got to change the mind. And we can really see this in India. So when people become Buddhists, it's not that they necessarily immediately change their economic situation. But they feel free. Because, of course, the first thing that becoming a Buddhist will teach you in India or anywhere is that notions of things like untouchability are just not true. You're just not. It's just a state of mind. It's not you or who you are. So people feel free and they feel dignified. And because they feel free and feel dignified, they can take responsibility for their lives and make real changes. I mean, people take real changes in India that put Western Buddhists to shame, I think. You know, I've seen all sorts of things, like people, you know, more than one occasion, someone's told me about someone who's an alcoholic, who's unable to function in their jobs because they're spending all the money on education, on alcohol, and they can't educate their children. It's a terrible situation. And they do things like someone went on a weekend retreat or even a day retreat and just completely gave up alcohol, just completely like that, and transformed not only their lives but the lives of their family. Because the mind was changed, because they felt different, they felt, actually, I am capable of enlightenment. Well, we're all capable of enlightenment. And once we really believe that, we'll put into place the necessary changes. And of course, Buddhism emphasizes love. It not only emphasizes our own self-dignity, but our dignity in relation to others. So I think it gives new significance to the practice of the Metta Bhavana meditation. Because the Metta Bhavana meditation not only transforms ourselves, it not only transforms our personal relations with each other, but it actually forms the basis for fraternity and democracy itself. By doing the Metta Bhavana, it's not just about us. We're doing something very, very radical for society itself and for the way that we live as a society. If everybody could do the Metta Bhavana, if Trump could do the Metta Bhavana, if Theresa May could do the Metta Bhavana, you know, what kind of society would we have? So sometimes I reflect on that as I'm going into the Metta Bhavana. I think, don't underestimate the Metta Bhavana. This is what it's really about. It's not just me having a warm, fuzzy feeling at the end of an afternoon. It's the basis for democracy. If I believe in democracy, then I've got to do the Metta Bhavana. Dr. Ambedkar said, without karuna or love, compassion, society can neither live nor grow, and that is why the Buddha made it a cornerstone of his religion. So without love, society can neither live nor grow. And if we want society to live or grow, we have to make an absolute commitment, not only to ethics, but to metta. And to have a vision of ourselves as just part of humanity and seeing humanity as basically one. So Dr. Ambedkar shifts our perspective. Buddhism isn't just about me. It's about transforming society so that all individuals can grow. And sometimes it can be uncomfortable to think in these terms, because we tend to think, particularly in the West, about religion being a private thing. And one mustn't sort of spread religion or talk about it ever, you know. Dr. Ambedkar said, religion, it is said, is personal and one must keep it to oneself. One must not let it play its part in public life. He said, contrary to this, Dharma is social. It is fundamentally and essentially so. So what he's saying here is actually, don't just keep it to yourself. Because Buddhism is very important for society. It creates democracy. And if we believe in democracy, actually, Buddhism is a force for good in the world. It can change the world. So that's why it's very important. It's uncomfortable because, obviously, we've got a history in this country of people imposing their religion on other people in extremely unpleasant ways. We don't have to do that. We can just encourage people by our own being. And if people ask us, say, well, I'm a Buddhist, and this is what I practice. And don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid of saying, I'm practicing Buddhism. Even if it's, you know, people coming to an introductory class and saying, oh, I went to an introductory class at the Buddhist Centre and this is what I learned. Actually, that sows the seed for a true democratic mind and changes society. So that's the external level, but also I think we can go a bit deeper than that and look at it in an internal level. And I think Dr. Ambedkar is important to us internally as Buddhists because he's an inspiration to us. He's an inspirational Buddhist figure. Sangharakshita called him one of the great Buddhists of the 20th century. So him himself, the figure of Dr. Ambedkar himself. And Sangharakshita has talked about how Dr. Ambedkar is one of his inspirations and influenced him deeply in his work in the West. He influenced him because of his concern for the oppressed and the exploited, and Sangharakshita said he resonated very strongly with that concern and was inspired by what he was trying to do for the oppressed. And he was very influenced by this, he said, because it was a religious revolution that was achieved by peaceful means. And he said what it really taught him is it taught him the social dimension of Buddhism, and it taught him that change is possible by spiritual means. And that's a very, very inspiring message, because sometimes we can look at the political situation, we can look at what's happening in the world, and we can feel quite helpless. I feel quite helpless. I'm the daughter of journalists, and I was always grew up with a knowledge of what's happening in the world. And for me, this really influenced my life. I remember standing in front of the news when there was a Zeebrugge disaster. I don't remember if people remember that, but the doors were left open of the ferry and lots of people died. And I was 10, and I remember watching it thinking, I'm going to eat my breakfast and everything's all right for me. But it's not all right for those families, the families of the people who died. They can't just eat their breakfast normally. I know this is a 10-year-old's mind. And I thought, I cannot live my life for my life alone. I have to live a life that includes the suffering of others. And I made an absolute dedication to that at that point when I was 10. Actually, I decided to be a nun, but I got the wrong religion. Anyway, that was you know, we can have a sense that, you know, there's these things going on in the world. And what can we do to help that doesn't just add to the problem? And Dr. Ambedkar shows us that actually change is possible by spiritual means, you know, by peaceful means, by revolution of mind. And that's true, you know, that's happened in India. So I haven't looked at anything later than this, but in the 2011 census, just to give you some figures, 61.7% of the Buddhist women of the scheduled castes, were literate, compared to 41.9% of the scheduled castes who weren't Buddhists. So there's something about being a Buddhist that actually picks up female literacy, work participation, stops female infanticide. Anyway, these are these little figures that I tend to look up. But what it shows is that actually, even from the same community, if people convert to Buddhism, they do much better economically and socially. So yes, it sort of worked. People who did become Buddhists have changed, have done much better economically and socially. And this is why what Sangharakshita also said. He said Dr. Ambedkar really inspired him because he showed that he was teaching the Dharma not just in an intellectual way, but in a way that people made real changes in their lives. And he said it made him realise that actually you can't just take on the Dharma as a social kind of construct. Actually, you've got to make real changes. And he said that he set up the movement in the UK on the same principle, that we're not just going to take up Buddhism by name only or as a set of ideas. We're taking up Buddhism to make real changes in our lives. And those changes are real, they're not superficial changes. And he said often the changes that people make in the West are different from the changes people make in India, but we're one Sangha. We're not just leaving the Dharma to stay on the shelf for a convenient moment. It's who we are, it's what we believe, and it's how we live. And he said that unites the Sangha throughout the world. And what's interesting about Sangharakshita is he said that perhaps among my strongest feelings are the feelings that I have for the so-called untouchables. So for that community, he said, those are the strongest feelings I have. Because he saw that it wasn't just an intellectual, it wasn't just an intellectual connection that people had with the Dharma. They really felt it, and they felt it as strongly as Sangharakshita feels it himself. And I think this is true for me as well, actually. There's something about a real feeling like the Dharma transforms people's lives. It transforms society. It sort of saved me in a particular way. And that kind of feeling is the feeling that Panti Sangharakshita got when he was with the Buddhists from the scheduled caste. And he said it made him realise that actually it's going for refuge, it's Buddhist practice that it's important. It's not what people, not what culture people come from or class. That's not what's important. What's important is this real strength of feeling that one has for the Dharma, for the spiritual life, for the Buddha. And he said that moved him deeply. And I think, yes, that's also true of me. Reading about Dr. Ambedkar's life, I get the sense of someone who's so dedicated. I mean, he could have had anything he wanted. He could have had a really easy life. He could have lived in the UK or America or settled down, become a lawyer, become quite wealthy even. And he went through real hardship, real hardship, just to spread Buddhism to for the uplift of his own people, to make changes in society for his own people. And I think that moves me very deeply. You know, Indian politics has, you know, can be very, very corrupt. And even Dr. Ambedkar, even his critics, never accused him of any kind of corruption at all. He was absolutely dedicated to his ethical practice. You know, scrupulously honest and utterly dedicated for social change. And I think we need people like that in the world, actually. I think we need people who... figures like that to really look up to. I think for myself, I have a natural tendency to look up to people. And Dr. Ambedkar is sort of worthy of that. That's what I feel. It's like here is someone who really made changes in their life and made it from a Buddhist perspective, who thought that Buddhism could be an effective force in society, who really did something with his life, who was disciplined, who was honest, who was ethically upright, who gave his life for others, you know, who's a real bodhisattva. And so reading about his life inspires me very, very deeply, more than most things, actually. I think of him and I think of all the hardships he underwent because he really believed in something more than himself. And we need people like that. We need people who are going to help us believe in something more than ourselves and who believe that change is possible in society, through peaceful means, through spiritual means. I mean, how wonderful is that? You know, because if it was just about me sitting in this Buddhist centre, just focusing on myself and my own well-being, it's a bit limited in some way, you know. It's not enough for me. And I think there's something about Dr. Ambedkar that makes me kind of go back to that real heartfelt wish as a 10-year-old, to live my life to help eradicate the suffering of not just myself, but others as well. And it's a kind of worthy object of reverence and of gratitude. We need heroes. You know, they're unpopular. We don't like the idea of needing heroes, but we need that. We need someone who we can really look up to and really learn from. Actually, there's a Dr. Ambedkar movie online, which I recommend you watch. It's about 3 hours long, but it's fine. What also moved me very much when I last saw it, which was recently, was his wife. He married his wife at when she was 9 and he was 14. And basically, you know, she brought up their children. 4 of their children died, and some of it was because they were very poor, because all the money went into Dr. Ambedkar's education. And it must have been very difficult for her, because he was away for long periods of time in America or the UK. But she also believed in something more than herself and even her family. She put that kind of faith in him, that he was going to do something really good for society, a benefit to society. And it must have been enormously difficult for her. Yeah, but I find that very beautiful in a way, to really have that conviction, there's something more than myself. So that's internally, that's the kind of inspiration that Dr. Ambedkar gives us as Buddhists. But I think there's also something secret, and this is what I'll end with. So it wasn't just that Dr. Ambedkar inspired Sangharakshita. They had 3 meetings, which if you read the book, you'll learn about. But on the last meeting, Dr. Ambedkar was very, very ill. He'd just converted, along with his followers, to the Dharma. But it was clear he hadn't long to live. So he converted in October and died in December. And Sangharakshita went to see him along with some other Buddhists, and he was very ill indeed. And as he was talking to him, he said his head was just moving towards the table because he was so ill. And Sangharakshita kept on saying, "Well, you must rest now, you know, you must rest now." And he just kept on talking. Apparently he talked for 2 hours, and the main message was he was very concerned with what would happen to these new Buddhists. And Sangharakshita said he felt as if there was this weight that was moving from Dr. Ambedkar to himself, this weight of responsibility. And a few months later, he died. And Sangharakshita was in Nagpur, which is interesting because he wasn't meant to be in Nagpur. He just had this sense, absolute sense, that he had to be in Nagpur. He didn't know why, but he was convinced. So even though his friends were encouraging him to stay with them in Mumbai, he went to Nagpur. And the evening that he got there, he got the news that Dr. Ambedkar had died. And a big public meeting was called. And the speakers just couldn't speak because they were overwhelmed with sadness and suffering. And as soon as they got the microphone to speak, they just burst into tears. And Sangharakshita said he felt very moved himself, but he knew he had to speak. You know, he had to kind of gather people together. And so he did. And in those few days, he ended up giving 40 talks, about 40 talks, and initiated about 30,000 people into Buddhism. And he said while he was speaking, he had an extraordinary experience. He said above the crowd, there hung an enormous presence, whether that presence was Ambedkar's own departed consciousness still hovering over his followers, or whether it was the collective products of their thought at that time of trial and crisis, I don't know. But it was as real to me as the people I was addressing. And he said that he wasn't tired by giving all those talks. He felt he was part of a force greater than his own. And he said he was acting decisively and effectively, but from an energy that was outside of himself. It wasn't that it was unrelated to himself, but he felt he was pulled along by something, unconnected with self-interest. And he said, my own spiritual experience during this period was most peculiar. I felt that I was not a person, but an impersonal force. At one stage, I was working quite literally without any thought, just as one is in samadhi. Also, I felt hardly any tiredness, certainly not at all what one would have expected from such a tremendous strain. When I left Nagpur, I felt quite refreshed and rested. And Subhuti has pointed out quite rightly, I think, that this experience is similar to the described experience of the bodhicitta, an experience that arises when we're no longer motivated by our own self-interest and self-orientated action, but instead feel as if a suprapersonal force is working through us, benefiting all beings. And I think what's interesting about that experience to me is that the other time that Sangharakshita talked about having that experience was when he founded the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, or the Western Buddhist Order at the time. He said it again as if it was a force greater than himself that was working through him. And he said rather than it being him that was taking on the responsibility of founding the order and movement, he said it was as if the responsibility took on me. He described it as though a suprapersonal energy or force was working through me, an energy or force for which, in a way, I was not responsible. And so when I think about this, I think about the force that must have motivated Ambedkar, because to go through that trial and hardship, to have that real dedication for the uplift of society and the removal of inequality, he must have had a real sense of the Bodhisattva ideal and a real sense that something greater than him was working through him. And as I said, he had a vision of creating a pure land, which wasn't just limited to India, but would cover the whole world, that in which the whole world could participate. And in a way, I think of that force, it's not even that Sangharakshita was inspired by Dr. Ambedkar, it's almost a force that moved through Ambedkar, moved through Sangharakshita, maybe was transferred to Sangharakshita at a particular time. And I think it's significant that in the end it was the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, the order that Bhante founded, that does so much work in India, that there will be, you know, a third of our order is in India and about half of our movement. And we're part of that because, of course, the weight that Ambedkar gave to Sangharakshita doesn't just stay with him. It's given to us as practicing Buddhists, to the extent that we are practicing Buddhists. We've got to make our Dharma practice relevant for our society and use our Dharma practice to build society and to create an environment for spiritual growth. And we must believe that Buddhism is a benefit not just to ourselves, but for society. And that's why Dr. Ambedkar is important, because he turns our heads, he makes us look around and see the significance of what Buddhism is, and maybe get a sense of that force that was working through Ambedkar, through Panti, working through us. I was talking to my father recently, and he was actually crying. Actually, my father does cry quite a lot, but anyway. He was crying. He was saying that for he's watched everything that his generation has fought for being eroded. He said respect for women, international cooperation, standing up to nationalism, exposing corruptions, race equality, financial equality, all those things that his generation fought for are being eroded. He said, I really believe that I would leave a better place for my grandchildren, and I don't believe that I am. That's a terrible thing. He said, I'm getting old and I feel that the world is not the better place that I thought we could make it. So I think that now more than ever, we need an ethical system that's based on liberty, equality and fraternity. We need people to inspire us. And more than all of that, we need to be motivated by a force greater than ourselves. So I'm just going to finish with the Bodhisattva vows, because this is what Dr. Ambedkar finished his book, The Buddha and the Dharma. He finished his book, The Buddha and His Dharma, with the Bodhisattva vows. Though the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Though greed, hatred and delusion rise endlessly, I vow to cut them off. Though the Dharma is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though the Buddha's way is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully.